Deirdre Noonan is a Canadian orthopedic surgeon, born and raised in Saskatchewan, who has made multiple visits as a trauma surgeon to war-torn and suffering parts of the world, and for the last several years has been working in Gaza. But Deirdre is not just a surgeon. She's also someone who has developed some clear thinking about the state of the world and what each of us might or even must do in our turbulent and often overtly chaotic times. Welcome, Deirdre, to Planetary Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're delighted to have you because what you have to share with listeners is something that a lot of people, I think, must at least hear, if not act on, but at least know that it's happening. Now, I was going through some of your previous comments and presentations, and I came across about 5 years ago, you were doing a presentation for MSF, that's Doctors Without Borders, in Humboldt, Saskatchewan, directly north of your hometown of Lanigan. And you said this, you said, it doesn't matter where you're from or what you do, you can always make a difference in the world. Now, in another article, which was in Broadview magazine, which is associated with the United Church, but not sponsored by them totally, you said this, you said, what I'm living through right now is the worst thing I've ever experienced. You were in Gaza. But then you added, yet I have an enduring sense that this is where I need to be. So I wonder if you could put those three comments you made together and give us a sense of what's the theme that runs through them and connects them all.
I think the nature of the human experience, and I think the meaning of life is helping other people. And the very basic literal interpretation of that often for people is things like becoming a doctor, and particularly a doctor working in humanitarian medicine internationally. We kind of get held up as a bit the prototype of here is how to help people. But it is a very uncreative way of looking at things. And it's a very narrow way of looking at things because, of course, there's no way that I could even get to where I'm going without people that do other types of jobs. I could not do any of the work without the infrastructure and the support and the team that I work with as a physician. And a lot of change in the world does not happen in terms of one person doing a hands-on kind of job. It's actually coming from a lot farther away, and it's coming from people that are working in policy, in education, in bigger picture, in governance. And so while I am maybe the figurehead in some ways, I'm not the whole boat. And I think sometimes we privilege this role to say, okay, here's a surgeon that she's doing all of these things. She's given up all of this. And wow, she's really doing this work. Some people look at it as an, I could never do that. Other people look at it and say, I wish I could do that. But this is not the only way to help. And in fact, it is far from being the best way to help. And so that is why I often end up coming back to Saskatchewan. It is where I want to be. And some of those are selfish personal reasons that I work at my dream job. This is what I wanted to do since I was a child. So in some way, I really, in most ways, I don't feel like I deserve a lot of the praise that I get. But I also want to make sure that people that I have the opportunity to talk to, they don't see what I'm doing as the only way to help, that they are able to see what they can do in their own lives at home.
Well, you know, we'll get into talking about your background in a bit, because like there's some roots in your life that give a sense of why this orientation is important. But the one thing I think I hear you saying loud and clear is that we all have a need to actuate ourselves in a way that feels good. And if it's good, it often means that we help other people. We grow ourselves through the act of helping other people. Now, you're just back at the end of July from another tour of duty in Gaza. A stark contrast with Canada. What is that transition going from this very particular kind of environment back to the kind of world that you were raised in, but is now only one of the worlds you know about. What's it like to come back?
In some ways, I don't think it's as jarring as a lot of people think it would be, probably because I've done it so many times.
Yeah, I was going to say you practiced.
I was also, I had some experiences traveling internationally when I was quite young. And so I think some of the struggling to get over ping-ponging back and forth between vastly different environments, a bit of that I was able to deal with in my teens. Mm-hmm. I still do find myself noticing the contrasts and noticing the different implications of things. So I'm in Victoria right now, staying at a friend's house. As I was coming out of the car and into the house just now, there is a helicopter flying over. And we're in Victoria.
So my goodness.
It's probably, you know, it might be a news helicopter. It might be a police helicopter. It might be a
weather helicopter.
It is not an Apache war helicopter. It is not firing at people. It is not taking wounded or dead Israeli soldiers off of the location of the Gaza Strip, which was, when I was in Gaza, those were really the only reasons to hear a helicopter.
Yeah, yeah.
And so
terrifying.
I feel this real disconnect that I it's not as though I have a flashback, but I just am very aware of how the same thing has such different implications.
I think it's called operant conditioning. It is unavoidable when you are exposed to these kinds of stimuli. They're call them stimuli. One thing that you do have is you keep the connection with your friends and colleagues in Gaza going. And I'm wondering if there's a certain continuity that arises out of having friends and people with whom you have warm relations in both environments. That's the human element is sort of a commonplace in both settings. Is that something that you notice?
What I sometimes find is that, especially with Gaza, especially in the last 23 months, I find that mentally that's the place where my mind goes most often. And so I can be focused on something here in Canada, doing my work here in Canada. But then once that moment of need to concentrate is gone, my thoughts drift towards Gaza. And so I feel a little bit as though I've got a foot in two places. And when I go to Gaza, that feeling resolves to an extent because I'm immersed in this reality rather than getting little snippets of it from the news, from conversations with friends. And so in Canada, I do have more of a feeling of disjointedness, of looking around and seeing a world around me that is unchanged in the last 2 years, whereas Gaza has been changed beyond recognition.
Very much so.
Not only in terms of Gaza, but in the greater sense, the world is changing in terms of the geopolitical tendencies now, and the world is always changing, but to me it feels like a time of accelerated change. Sometimes I feel like I can't keep up. And so even here, it's quite strange to look around and the physical world seems the same as always. But when I turn on the news, holy smokes, there are a lot of things that I don't recognize and I would never imagined happening in my lifetime or at this stage in my lifetime.
So home is a relative term. Obviously, your official home was this country, but you have become the immersive nature of the world in Gaza is so powerful that it seems to me, as an observer from afar, it is impossible to be in that world without being immersed in sensory and psychological experiences that are really quite overwhelming. If you were trying to name a home, you said this is your home, but when we were talking earlier, you said, well, Moose Jaw is a home. When you have more than one home, how do you distinguish the one that is the home, or does it just you realize that there can be any home that you happen to find yourself in, really?
Quite a long time ago, this would have been in 2016 in Australia, I came across a piece of art and it had the caption, it was public art, and the caption was, I think it was, "Home is where we sleep now." And I thought that that really is my personal feeling of home. And I have a tendency to accidentally refer to other people's houses where I'm staying for 1 to 2 days. I'll refer to it as going home. And so I have quite a fluid sense of home. There are definitely some places in the world where I feel very settled. And Saskatchewan is definitely one of them. When I get off that plane onto a highway, I see these wide open prairie landscapes in the big sky. That's something that feels right and natural to me. But then at the same time, in Gaza, although the landscape does not comfort, quite the opposite right now, but my Palestinian friends in Gaza, they often tell me, they say, this is your home, or you're coming home. And I take that very, very seriously, to feel that generosity of people who in many ways have been denied a homeland, now denied a home, but are still offering this belonging to me. And I do feel settled when I'm in Gaza. As tumultuous as these constant attacks have made it, as much grief and suffering as there is a certain rightness to the feeling when I am there.
I remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Deirdre Noonan, who is a Canadian orthopedic surgeon born and raised in Saskatchewan. When we were talking earlier, you said, I feel more stressed when I'm doing locums in Moose Jaw. And that's an interesting comment, and I can see why it would happen. But why don't you just let listeners in on why that is more stressful to be doing, doing amputations and horrendous interactions and seeing stuff like that around you all the time in Gaza. But it's more stressful. Why?
I think it's both one of the good and one of the terrible things about the human condition is that we can get used to many things. We can also become accustomed to things that nobody should ever become accustomed
to. Indeed.
And so the day-to-day course of my work in humanitarian medicine, it involves open fractures, often horrendous injuries where limbs are basically torn or partially torn from bodies. And when there are many cases where I cannot save the patient's limb and I'm forced to amputate. And there are different levels to which this is true, but in Burundi, when most of my patients were injured in road traffic accidents with motorcycles, even though it was not these injuries with the violently traumatic weapons of war that have been designed to harm, I was still seeing things that were far out of what my normal practice in Saskatchewan would be like. And so over the years, because I've spent more time working internationally than I have in Canada, what is bread and butter for a Canadian orthopedic surgeon, and they're seeing all the time, and it doesn't even, you don't really have to think fully to, you can go on autopilot.
Yes.
That's not my autopilot anymore. And so I'm lucky to be supported by very understanding colleagues when I do come back and work in Canada, who are always at the other end of the phone when I want to discuss a case. Typically, I'm calling them and saying, guys, there's a very tiny fracture and I don't know what to do with it.
You know, you used a phrase that stuck in my mind and I've written it down here. Comfortably pedestrian, this part of the world is in a way, and there's something comfortable about it being pedestrian in a sense. But you also pointed to something else, that the staff at the hospital in Moose Jaw is quite multicultural. It's not, you know, white, you know, Anglo-Saxon Protestants or whatever. It's quite divergent. Why don't you talk about that a little bit? Because that's a new thing in this world, to have people everywhere from everywhere.
For a long time in Saskatchewan, we've depended on internationally trained physicians to work in rural areas. And that's actually how I ended up in Saskatchewan, being born in Saskatchewan, because my father was trained in Ireland. And early in his career, when he was looking for jobs, at one stage, he called a friend from his graduating class who was working in Saskatchewan. And so my dad ended up in Saskatchewan in the 1960s. And I remember growing up that we would often welcome new doctors from the surrounding towns, and they would come over to the house for a family dinner. And my mother would often make a South African dessert that she had learned how to make, because very often those people coming were white South African families, because there was a stage where that was the main source of internationally trained physicians coming to rural Saskatchewan. It's gone through various iterations of different countries. And in Moose Jaw, when I started working there in 2017, would have been, I was impressed with reading down the list of physician names on the on-call roster, and it was a whole world. Yes. We had people from just about every continent. I don't know that there's a lot of Australian and Oceania representation, but that's the only place that I can really immediately think that there's not a strong representation.
Sorry to interrupt, but I was just thinking how the world has changed because of widespread digital, constant digital communications. What we have in many people's minds in this part of the world is we have too much of everything. And I want to talk a little bit about food, because food, the issue of food and what it is and where it comes from has played an enormous role in Gaza. It's weaponized, of course, as you're well aware. What do you eat in Canada? I just want to start there, because that's a place where we can talk about food that you have easy access to and you can make choices about.
Well, for some reason, when I got back from Gaza in the spring, I went through a phase where the only thing I really wanted to eat was raisins and carrots. it's that still
Waldorf salad. Here we come.
Yes. Yeah, there are a few recipes that you can make on that basis. But I was mainly going just for a handful of raisins in one hand and a carrot in the other. But that is one thing that is sometimes still a bit hard to go between different food cultures sometimes, or different food availability. And it is sometimes difficult to get back into a pattern of what would be considered normal eating within Canada. And that was especially the case the last two times I came back from Gaza.
The feeling of the food situation in Gaza is so all-pervasive. I mean, there are people running to get a box that might have food in it. There are people scrambling, you know, almost over one another. What do you eat and your colleagues eat in Gaza? Because you're almost a sort of special, separate situation in some respects.
So during the last year in Gaza, what I have eaten is frequently dehydrated, ready-made hiking meals, where you just add water and weight, of varying quality and taste profiles, but they've got calories in them, they've got nutrients in them. And then some of the available food, which would be pita bread, rice, lentils. The variety of food that was available in Gaza really, it was decreasing towards the, in the early half of November when I was there. I could see a lack of food and food disappearing from my colleagues' plates. When we came back in February, it was comparatively, there was more varied food, more plentiful food, given that it was the ceasefire and there were fewer restrictions being placed on food being brought into Gaza. But then on March 2nd, a complete siege was imposed and the Israeli authorities were blocking any food trucks from entering Gaza whatsoever. And literally in the course of days, I saw meat disappear, I saw chicken disappear. Then within a few weeks, corned beef and tuna suddenly became the most prized things one might have. Tomatoes that were and cucumbers grown locally, the price was climbing. Bread became harder and harder to find. So it's a fluctuating kind of landscape. Because I am able to bring in a suitcase and I'm able to bring in some food with me, I've tried to eat my own food when I can and leave the food that is available in Gaza for Palestinian people to eat, because there is not enough of it for them.
But I think it's important to state now that there is overt starvation. There are people dying from a lack of food.
Yes, and so we've reached the official level of famine, which is declared by the IPC, which is a dedicated international organization. So
Yes.
now there's is truly famine in Gaza, and so this is not a subjective matter, but it does pair with what I was seeing, which was colleagues that were losing weight and visibly thinner every single time I saw them, and patients who were the thinnest population that I have treated. Of course, not everybody in Gaza is dangerously thin. You can't see malnourishment with your eyes, but you can certainly pick out those people who have lost an incredible amount of weight, are just skin and bones, and it's to the case where I could compare many of my patients in Gaza to a few patients that I've had in other countries that are dying of another disease, and even taking in nourishment does not put meat on their bones.
Sure.
And so I have seen things that shock me in terms of how thin my patients in Gaza were, in terms of how thin some of my colleagues were.
We cannot talk about food in Gaza without talking about the pernicious Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Could you describe this? I'm going to call it a travesty. I hope I'm not being too overt about it, but talk about it, because a lot of people have a funny idea about what this entity is and what it's doing.
So this is something that was new in Gaza between when I left on April 17th and when I came back in July. And it was at the end of May that this organization started working in Gaza for the first time. And I had heard reports about it when I was still in Canada. But when I got to Gaza on the 5th of July, that was my first day in the hospital. In the evening, I had a young man come up in with a gunshot wound to his forearm, really destroyed bone and tissue. And I asked him what happened. And he said, I went to the American aid, and then he mimed shooting. The American aid is what people would commonly refer to the GHF or the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation as. And the next patient I had was a little girl, injured that day, 12 years old. And I asked the nurses what happened to her, and they said GHF. And this little girl had a gunshot wound. It was very typical sort of anatomy of a gunshot wound, with about a 2 centimeter entry wound on one side of her leg and about 15 centimeter diameter exit wound on the other side. So suggesting that this is a high velocity rifle that's imparting a lot of energy to the tissue as it goes through. And the nurses told me that her father had been shot and killed at that same spot. So those were my two first patients that I speak about them a lot because that was my introduction firsthand to treating people that were shot while trying to get food. And this is not something that I have seen anywhere else in the world. And it got so that in Gaza, I found that my first assumption, anytime I saw a gunshot wound, my assumption was that it was GHF because that is how common it was. I would always check with a patient to confirm and understand under what circumstances did this occur. But well over 90% of the gunshot wounds that I was seeing were incurred in exactly this way. A person who was forced to starve, then to walk to a food distribution that had been announced, and in the course of trying to get food, was shot.
These announcements about food being available often say that it'll be available for 10 minutes or an hour, maybe at the most, but it's never like a store that's open all day long. It's open for these very brief intervals. The number of sites is radically reduced from what was available from previous nonprofit organizations that were distributing food. It seems to me, and you could perhaps illuminate this. It seems to me that it's a system designed to bring out the deepest sort of level of need in people and then, as it were, penalize them along the way. That's the sense I get.
Well, I just think from a sort of a logical viewpoint, if you want to get food to people, you try to bring it to where the people are as close as they can access as possible. And you try to make it available for longer periods of time so that people are able to come and get the food. I mean, it's a completely different conversation, but earlier today I was talking with a friend about Canadian urban landscapes and where we put our grocery stores and are they walkable and are they accessible? And I mean, the same principles of where we need grocery stores applies, that ideally people should be able to easily access a grocery store, and that grocery store should be open long enough hours that people with different working hours are able to get to a store and buy food. The idea of taking an aid distribution system that used to involve UNRWA alone had more than 400 aid distribution points in Gaza. The GHF, when I was there, had 4. Those 4 points were inside militarized zones where people had been ordered to evacuate from. There is no transportation system. A donkey cart or a taxi in which many, many people are crammed, including into the trunk, and usually there's a little cart pulled behind it. Those are exorbitantly expensive ways to move around Gaza, and so people have to go on foot. And the announcements on the Facebook page of the GHF, where the opening and closing times are noted, ask people not to come early. But how on earth can one think about arriving early or not when arriving means walking sometimes many kilometers across a very unsafe and difficult terrain of destroyed buildings? So as you say, it certainly does not apply to any of the principles that one would think if one wanted to get food into people's hands.
Well, I think at least listeners should know that this system was designed right after October the 7th by the Israeli government. They had conversations and decided that they would set up a system that does what it's doing today, because it was going to be, they thought, something that would make the life of the Hamas resistance more difficult. But unfortunately, the way they're making it more difficult is by penalizing ordinary citizens. The fact that it's also an American commercial venture, it's being taken on by a private company, not a public agency, not a nonprofit. You can see the forces at work creating this, what can only be described as a monster, with food as the bait. Just stepping back a little bit, you've been going back and forth to Gaza now for a number of years. When you have these thoughts about Gaza, because you said they come to you a lot, what are the thoughts? What kind of thoughts do you have? They're not all about pain and suffering, or are they?
A great deal of the thoughts that I have about Gaza are the very sort of immediate and short-term thoughts that I wonder about my friends there. I wonder how they are. I wonder where they are. I wonder what their living conditions are. Are they in a tent? Are they in a destroyed building? Are they in the same place or the same dwelling that they were in the last time I spoke with them? Sometimes I wonder, are they still alive? Early on, I used to find the very strange comfort in saying, if they had been killed, someone would have told me. But as time goes on and communication within Gaza gets harder and harder, I'm no longer always convinced that the network between my friends is as strong as it once was. And so they may not know if someone else has been killed. And so it may not be possible for them to tell me. And so it's very personal and it's generally very immediate. I think I avoid letting myself too often think about bigger pictures or longer term because it pushes me towards despair.
Yes, and that despair, as you noted when we were talking earlier, is now beginning to be shared by more and more people, in the sense that people are realizing how bad things really are. When you first were working in Gaza, you said you'd get angry when you came back and you saw the privileged population of this part of the world. But things have changed for you. What's changed in that in your mind when you come back here and you realize that people have so much more than anything you would ever see in Gaza?
I think that that anger that predated working in Gaza by quite a long time. That was sort of what I saw as a child and as a teenager. That was when I had anger. I came to, I don't want to say accept, because I don't think I've really accepted the incredible disparities that exist within our world, even the ones that exist within Canadian society. I don't accept those.
I hope you don't ever accept them. We'll be together and not accepting them.
I think I have become accustomed to moving back and forth between extremes. But what I look at now when I come back to Canada that I wonder at a bit is the disconnect. And to see people and to hear people themselves say that they intentionally do not learn about the rest of the world, that they do not want to know what is happening in the wider world because it is distressing to them. And I think that is a profound example of privilege, and it's a very worrying disconnectedness.
Yes.
Have that as a whether it's a coping mechanism or a survival mechanism or simply to save oneself from the discomfort of ugly truths. No matter what you are doing, we're all in this together. And with globalization, the small actions of your daily life, even if it seems like you're minding your own business, doing your own job and raising your own kids, every moment of that, unless you're living off grid in a very isolated area, every moment of your normal private life has global implications.
Yes.
And so I cannot agree with people that take this approach of willful
ignorance. Willful ignorance. It's interesting. I had a conversation with somebody earlier today who's involved with food security and working on it. And she said, you know, I feel overwhelmed and unsure what's coming next. And we congratulated each other because I said, I feel the same way a lot of the time. And I think, you know, somebody said, if you feel sane in an insane world, then you really have mental health problems. And I think there's increasing difficulty in isolating oneself from the realities of the world that are the realities of every part of the world, it's just in greater or lesser quantities in some respects. Now, you've been doing a lot of presentations. The CBC's taken a significant interest in hearing what you have to say and disseminating it. What are you noticing? Are you seeing a gradient upwards in the interest and the awareness that, you know, just talking about some people choose to negate or obviate? Are you seeing more in that regard over the years that you've been going to back and forth to Gaza?
I mean, despite it all, I remain an eternal optimist. And so I am not a reliable narrator in this respect.
We'll accept your bias if necessary.
I keep on checking in with other people to say, look, this is what I'm seeing. Are you seeing it too? And what I am seeing is that, particularly if we just focus on Gaza itself, more people are noticing that something is happening. More people are concerned with a genocide being committed in our times. More people are unwilling to continue to be implicated in this genocide by way of what our government is doing, what the economic systems are doing, what our charitable structures are doing in the world. And more people want to do something to make a difference. And so the talks that I've been doing, part of it is due to the people that are organizing it and the incredible work that they've been doing advertising, but the attendance has been extremely good, even at short notice, even at odd times of the day, even in small communities. A lot of people are coming out. We're having question and answer periods that are often my favorite part of the presentation. people are donating a great deal of money, which is very generous and shows an interest in engaging. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, because of the ongoing blockade of Gaza, because of the Israeli limitations and restrictions placed on aid organizations and UN agencies, I'm still convinced that at this moment in time, money is not the answer, but advocacy, education, outspokenness, and government lobbying are what we need. But just seeing that people want to make some sort of contribution is giving me a lot of hope that I didn't have before.
Remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Deirdre Noonan, who's a Canadian orthopedic surgeon who has been working in Gaza off and on for a number of years and doing trauma and orthopedic surgery, as well as now some management stuff. You're moving, your broad experience is starting to show up. Now, when I say broad experience, that's not a misstatement. You started a long time ago, I believe it was in Ethiopia, your first offshore experience with orthopedic surgery, but also trauma surgery. And at that time, you felt a little bit overwhelmed by the some of the trauma surgery you were having to participate in. And then you had a colleague who spoke to you and said something that you found reassuring in that Ethiopia stint. Can you just, do you remember that? You described, somebody said something about your feeling, you know, inadequate and out of your depth. And it was after that that you went and did a fellowship in trauma surgery. But I just listed them off here. I'm just going to rattle them off. Haiti, Syria, back to Haiti, Burundi, Gaza, Burundi again, Gaza, Iraq, Central African Republic, and now Gaza several times. And I'm sorry this is a bit irreverent, but I thought have scalpel, will travel was something could be applied. But what I wanted you to share with listeners is what are the commonalities to those experiences and the differences? Where was something happening that seemed to happen nowhere else, and where were those patterns being established?
First, I want to say that I wasn't a little bit out of my depth in Ethiopia. I was completely out of my depth. And I was in a hospital that absolutely had none of the resources that I needed to practice orthopedic surgery. And I was in a position of trying to find a way that my very high income country education and experience could be used without doing more harm in an environment that looked nothing like where I was coming from, and patients that were presenting with injury types or disease timelines that were completely different from what I was used to. And the only way that I got through that and that my patients did not suffer far more from mismanagement than they otherwise might have were because of two Ethiopian surgeons. One was Tesfahan Welde, who was a general surgeon, very recently qualified, working side by side with me in Ethiopia. Infinite patience for all of these stupid things that I had no idea about. And then Dr. Sami Hailu in Addis Ababa, who trained with me in Toronto, and who therefore knew where I was coming from and where I had ended up. And he was essential in bridging those two worlds and telling me what to do in a way that he knew I would be able to do it and he knew I would understand. So without those two surgeons, I might have run back to Canada and never worked internationally again.
Well, we found them. We found them. You found them. The two people.
Or they found me.
Yes, they found you. But we found them today, which is important. And then you did a fellowship in trauma surgery. And what is different in learning the ins and outs of trauma surgery from orthopedic surgeon in general? Generally, there are trauma situations in a country like Canada, but they're fairly predictable and often in elderly people and that kind of thing. What was it that really got you moving ahead with the trauma fellowship training that you did? What did it change?
Well, I had done already one trauma fellowship in Sunnybrook before I went to Ethiopia. So that was in Toronto. And then I did a second fellowship in Perth, and I was rescued by an Australian orthopedic surgeon, Michael Wren, who looked at me and he said, "Girl, what are you doing?" He said I was too early in my career and trying to work in two different environments. And he was worried that I was going to get completely stuck, not have career opportunities, and maybe not have the kind of flexibility that I might need in my later life. So he arranged a fellowship position in Perth, and I went directly from Ethiopia to Australia for this. And even though it was still first world kind of trauma with primarily people injured in high-speed car accidents, elderly people with simple falls, and then all the regular injuries between those two, sporting injuries, workplace accidents, and I was still working with the whole complement of fancy equipment like MRI scans and all the internal fixation devices in a very well-constructed hospital. Now I had the ability to think about the Ethiopian context and the materials available, and to think about what I was doing in Australia, start to bridge that gap a little bit in my mind and understand what I couldn't do safely, but what I might be able to improvise and modify. And then the next big kind of learning step came when I was working in Syria, which was the first time that I had really been working with people who were injured with gunshot wounds and explosive injuries, a lot of improvised explosive devices that were left behind by Daesh in Raqqa that caused really appalling injuries. And again, I was working with a couple of international surgeons, one from Hong Kong and one from the Philippines, who had been working in humanitarian conflict zones and knew more than I knew in terms of how to treat those wounds. So those were my big stepping stones for learning. Of course, I'm still learning, but now becoming more comfortable that those are injuries that I know very well how to treat, and I'm very familiar with what needs to be done.
One of the senses I'm getting from you is how collegiality is enhanced when you're dealing with these kinds of medical situations, the surgical situations. They are never, no two situations are the same. There's always some likelihood that you may not see what you recognize, or that somebody else sees it better than you, or the other way around, that you see it and the person you're working with isn't aware of that, and you, but this bridge between practitioners is, it seems to me, is strengthened in the kind of trauma environment that you've been working in so many different places. Would that seem like, sounds like it.
It is, and being a surgeon, it's never a solo job wherever you're doing it. You are dependent completely on the team. That is each person fulfilling their own roles. And that for me has been the common factor every single place I've been, is that the operating room, there's a distinct culture in the operating room. And regardless of what country it's in and what the dominant culture is, I've found that the operating room culture takes precedence. And so whenever I go to another country, it can be the first time that I've been in this place, different language, different cultural norms, different people. I go to the operating room and I still feel
You feel at
that
home.
that is a place where I belong, another home.
Yes. Well, for somebody who's doing surgery and has attained significant competencies, that's a nice thing to have happen for the rest of us, that you feel at home when you're doing that kind of thing. Let's talk a little bit more about Gaza, because there's some unusual features of what's going on in Gaza. For example, the high proportion of civilians. Most violence and war these days involves more deaths of civilians than in than of combatants. But this, the situation in Gaza is even more extreme. The highest proportion of children now who've been injured and killed, not the highest absolute numbers, but the highest fraction of deaths or injuries, serious injuries to children, is taking place in Gaza. And it's now reckoned that there are more amputees in Gaza, or as a result of the violence in Gaza, than in any other country these days, simply because the intensity of and the ferocity of the assault by the Israeli Defense Forces is so profound. Listeners may not know that Israel has the fourth strongest military in the world after the United States, Russia, and China, and also that the United States has supplied Israel over the years with over $125 billion worth of military aid, and that was a figure from a couple of years ago. And in fact, Israel is the largest recipient of American weaponry ever, and that has created, and this is a quote from the Department of State, one of the most technologically sophisticated militaries in the world. Now, as a surgeon working in that setting, surrounded by this military superstructure, does it not make it a different experience in some respects from other places you've worked?
There are some ways in which, as a surgeon, because you're dealing with patients one by one, that it's not always very clear what the overall statistics might be. And so when I think about Syria as well, my patients in Syria were overwhelmingly civilians. I was seeing some young soldiers who were on duty at the border who were getting shot, and they would arrive in uniform, and it was clear that they were part of the Kurdish forces. But overwhelmingly, it was civilians trying to return to their houses, which had been booby-trapped by the retreating Islamic State, so-called. In Gaza, it was massive numbers of people being injured, and I would have a sense of this from going down into the emergency room and sometimes walking through there to cross to a different building of the hospital. I still could only treat patients one by one, and so my frame of reference is still limited to how many patients in some ways I can physically treat per day. But looking into the hospital wards, I could get a sense of how many children, how many women, how many elderly, how many men that were injured. And we see the statistics that in excess of 83% are civilians.
Indeed.
And of course, many times it's just perfectly obvious by who the person is that this is not anybody that was involved in,
right,
in anything resembling combat.
Yes, a 5-year-old child or a 23-year-old pregnant woman, very unlikely to be involved with that. Now, there's a unique situation with Gaza because it's a territory that Israel has considered its territory and is now talking very seriously about forcefully displacing the entire population of Gaza, and is doing the same what's called the West Bank, the occupied West Bank, which was originally not part of Israel. And there's in the United States, there's a population, a Jewish population, that's almost as big as the population in Israel. And so the United States government has had this sort of close relationship with Israel that has been complex at times. But there's this issue of saying something rude about or critical of the Israeli government being called anti-Semitism, which it isn't really. And I'm wondering if this comes up when you're doing presentations here, because some parts of the Jewish community, especially the Zionist, formally declared Zionist part, are pretty forceful sometimes. I've read some of the comments, for example, on writings you've done, and they're quite aggressive, shall we say, and very much of a theme. You know, you don't understand anything, you're completely misguided. Have you noticed that's different? Because other countries don't have that kind of, if you like, built-in lobby in a country like Canada.
Well, I think it's important that when we look at, you know, we say the U.S. Jewish population is almost equivalent in size to the Israeli Jewish population, but neither of those populations are monoliths. And
no.
So
oh, absolutely
there
not. Yes.
There are people that are dissenting in Israel, including the people that I've known and have had a chance to work alongside, that are anti-genocide activists, lawyers, physicians, from the Israeli Jewish community. Likewise, large vocal segments of the American Jewish population. And then also within North America, a lot of the ties with Israel are not necessarily related to Judaism at all, but related to Christian Zionism.
Indeed.
And some particular evangelical Christian beliefs about the interpretation of the Bible and what it says about the second coming of Jesus. Mm. So within Canada, we also have these diverse Jewish population with different priorities and beliefs, and who speak out on different issues in different ways.
Yeah.
And then also a Christian Zionist population as well, and a non-Zionist Christian population.
Right.
So it's a lot of different groups. And ultimately, when I meet people and talk to people, I'm talking with two people one-on-one, not as representatives of their communities. Because most of the speaking that I'm doing is at community events, and so people self-select when they come. And just about every single person, and certainly every vocal person at my presentations, has been somebody that comes wanting to hear what I have to say, sometimes having questions to understand more, sometimes requesting that I explain why what they're hearing in the mainstream media is different from what I'm saying. But I have not had personal encounters with people who have said anything aggressive, violent, even particularly critical. It's been good faith interactions between people. Sometimes people want to introduce themselves to me in terms of the community that they come from.
Mm-hmm.
And so in each talk that I do, there are frequently people from the Jewish community in Canada who are very active against genocide in solidarity with Palestinian people. And the online world, unfortunately, is a place where people seem to feel particularly free to express themselves in ways that
they would never do if they were face to face.
I would hope that people would not. I worry that some of the breakdown in society and the polarization that's happening, people are becoming more willing to engage in that sort of, I don't want to call it communication, because it's not communication. It's some of it borders on hate speech, or and so I don't engage with that sort of thing online. I would rather talk with people face to face.
Yes.
And I would rather not have an online presence, to be honest. I would much rather just keep on fixing bones.
Yes.
But right now, as I said before, fixing bones is not the solution. It's policy change. And so that comes by talking to people.
And what you're saying about, there are actually some strong voices within the Jewish community that are not at all supportive of what's going on in Gaza. In Canada, Independent Jewish Voices is a well-known group, and in the United States, yeah, Jewish Voice for Peace, very active and very articulate and very attached to Judaism and the principles of Judaism, which are very contrary to those being motivating the behavior that's going on in Gaza by the Israeli state. Now, I think we should talk a little bit. I said we'd talk about your origin story. Your father was Irish, although he was born in Wales, apparently. But Ireland was the first colony of Britain, of England at the time. And you had not only your father being Irish, but your grandfather was in the IRA, which is another qualification for saying injustice is not necessarily acceptable. But when you were very young, you already, in your own mind, had made it up that you were going to become a doctor. Why don't you just describe that day? Because you were not very old when the words came out of your mouth.
So two things. One is that my father was an incredible storyteller. And occasionally the lines between fact and fiction were blurred.
Well done. Well said.
Bringing in various mythologies into his stories.
Mm.
My sister and I, when we were very small, used to say, never believe what daddy says. And so he did mention that his father was fighting alongside the Irish revolutionaries that were fighting for independence from the British. But I've tried to go back and find any sort of record of that. So far, no. So was this part of the family history, or is it part of the family mythology? Not completely clear, but certainly my ancestors were proud Irish people who did not want to be subjugated or occupied. My grandfather, but my grandmother as well, was very outspoken about this.
Well, it's seeing somebody being outspoken is helpful if you're actually doing some public speaking. It's sort of say, well, I know how to do that. I've seen it a long time ago. Lanigan, Saskatchewan. It's south of Humboldt, as I mentioned earlier, and it's about one-sixth the size. It's east of Saskatoon, and it's creeping up to 1,500 people. What was it like growing up there? Just a bit of a capsule of those days for you, and your father being the family doctor obviously played a role.
It was home in a way that you never really analyze at that stage. My whole world was there, and my father was the family doctor there for more than 20 years ultimately, and I could see that role in interactions that I was Dr. Noonan's daughter. That was my identity, and his general practice was an old style general practice that included house calls. In the early years, it included doing his own maternity. He was on call for his patients every time he was in Lanigan until I was about 14 or 15 when they started a call sharing rota. And they actually, the police came to our house that night because we unplugged the phone, and it turned out that there was a special situation that needed someone who knew the patient to go back in. And so I saw that my father had a role in the hospital, but also that carried over into his role in the community. And I saw a way in which medicine was a vocation. And sometimes I got a very firsthand view of that when he would take me into the hospital on call and sit me at the nurse's desk, and I would color with the highlighters, or I would sleep in one of the pediatric beds while he delivered a baby, or when I was a bit older, cut the ends of his sutures as he was suturing. And I think I must have been 3 or 4 years old the first time I can remember somebody saying, "Are you going to be a doctor like your daddy when you grow up?" And I said, "Yes." And that was always the answer all along.
What was his thought about that? His daughter becoming a doctor?
He would always say, "She doesn't want a terrible job like this." And I sometimes taking me to the hospital with him was an attempt on his part to show me the
To
downsides of,
dissuade you.
yes,
I
and it backfired completely.
was going to say it wasn't he wasn't a good propagandist, clearly. He could do other things.
Definitely not. In my teens, he became satisfied that this was an independent decision. It wasn't sort of a product of some sort of feeling responsibility to keep on the family tradition of third generation Dr. Noonan. And so then he kept on taking me to work, but with the idea of showing me not in a negative way of what it was, but in a positive way.
We're coming to the end of our time, and I want to ask you what you, I mean, you've already declared yourself an eternal optimist, so we know where you stand on that. But I'm also wondering what you see as the responsibility of the world, meaning the people you said we talked about earlier, who maybe have up till now maintained or tried to maintain a state of willful ignorance. But of course, it's harder and harder to do that with global telecommunications and images and changing social values. I mean, they're actually returning to, I think, better social values as we see the outcome of what's going on, specifically in Gaza, but in war-torn areas around the world. What are you seeing as you look at the bigger picture? I mean, I know you said being an orthopedic surgeon, your comfort zone is in the operating room, which is quite reasonable. But what do you, when you're outside the operating room, what patterns do you see coming towards us?
It feels like we're in a great moment of upheaval in the world. I feel as though many of these cautionary novels that I read growing up seem to be have been used by as instruction manuals rather than cautionary tales. But from that upheaval, there is the potential for good to come of it. And when we are comfortable and there is no motivation for change, no necessity for change, then maybe society has a chance to stagnate. And recently I read something, this is not my wisdom, but it really caught my attention as something that's very relevant for today. And this idea that in North American society in particular, for a long time, we've been living with this idea that what is good for the individual will be good for the world. But in fact, what we're seeing is that that is not at all the case. And the way that we need to start living is to consider that what's good for the world is good for the individual. And so I hope that what we see as time goes on is a recognition of the importance of community, not just of the chosen communities that we have where we choose to associate with people who are like us, but of a pluralistic, true community where we have links between the people with whom we live and we support each other and communicate with each other, and that we make decisions, whether it's on a personal level or a higher governmental level, that we consider what is good for the big picture, the environment, the world, society at large, rather than what did we think was good for the individual, which has led us to a very fractured society with a lot of isolation of individual people and with a lot of social problems.
Deirdre, you're articulate, you're informed, you're experienced, you're skilled, and I think I can comfortably declare you a great asset for this community, this human community that we're working in. And I do thank you for joining us today on the show. It's been a delight to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.